Hi, this is William F. DeVault, sometimes known as the romantic poet of the internet, and certainly known as the host of From Out of the City. This week we're going to do something a little less musical, a little more literary, and focus on one particular concept, which is obscurantism. Now, that's a $3 word that ironically enough means the use of images and words that are obscure or arcane or too complex for your readership to understand. I had an editor, must have been about 2 years ago, apply that label to some of my works because I had included the word lute and blacksmith in one of my poems. That kind of shocked me, as poetry has a great literary tradition of being mired in the classic minstrel allegories and allusions. But this is something that is not uncommon in all forms of art, no matter what school you're in or from. The concept that if I don't get it, no one else will get it. This is one of the main reasons for the revolution that has been known as the Digital Renaissance. For a period of time, publishing and music and film have all fallen into a situation where a few hands control the bottlenecks. And if those few hands don't appreciate the work being done, do not resonate with the work that's being done, they do not allow it out to the mass audience. This is not an insult to them. It's merely a statement of fact that nobody likes everything. And if you are a publisher or an editor or a producer, then the fact that you like a particular type of literature, a particular style of writing, a particular style of music, leads you to lean in that direction as you release, market, prepare these works. And indeed, publishers and producers have an obligation, a financial obligation, to produce work that they believe in their heart of hearts is going to make a profit. It's going to contribute to the bottom line. We are, after all, in a world where we have to accept the fact that both literature and music, and all other forms of art, to some degree, fall within the realms of commerce. And there's nothing wrong with that. Commerce is good. I, for one, like to eat. I like to pay my bills. There's nothing inherently wrong with commerce. So what I'd like to do is sit here for a few minutes, read a few pieces of my works, discuss them with you, and maybe we can come to some agreement as to the nature of obscurantism, why it is not necessarily a bad thing, and why I am or am not of that label. In the 1960s, Stan Lee, who I've invoked before in this show, because he's somebody that I grew up reading the works of, who was the publisher, editor, and chief writer at Marvel Comics, hit upon the notion that you shouldn't write for the 9-year-old, you should write for the college-age crowd. As a result of this, the complexity of their characters, the origins of their characters, the language being used by their characters, became sophisticated to the point that often the demarcation line between a DC fan and a Marvel fan was who could pass their SAT test. The whole notion of not writing down to your audience, of not dumbing down your art, is very important to a lot of artists. Now, yes, to sell, you need to be able to connect with your audience. But just as the vast majority of people cannot tell you what the meanings of the lyrics in their favorite songs mean, so is it that they do not necessarily have to grasp every concept in everything they read. I personally have never actually seen the diagrams for how a caterpillar drive would work in a nuclear submarine, but I can assure you I did enjoy Tom Clancy's Hunt for Red October. Now, poetry is subject to this to a large extent because we are one of the most resonant of the arts. People can look at a pretty sculpture and go, that's pretty, without appreciating the art behind it. People can hear a song and enjoy the melody without necessarily understanding the angst or the joy that went into it. But so few people are actually educated into the nuances of the poetic arts that understanding what they read or what they hear is largely hinged upon how well they understand the words that get to them. As such, if you have an audience that is not understanding what you're saying, their ability to enjoy the work is greatly reduced. And it is important that we communicate. There are two ends to the communication belt that girdles any art form. There's the cathartic, in which the artist is creating to relieve pressure, to release a need, to express something. And then there's the receptive, where the cycle isn't complete until someone at the other end, whether one person or a stadium hall or a vast readership, actually gets the point of the work. And I understand that. I embrace that. I do know that sometimes I am guilty of using words larger than one syllable and that you wouldn't find on your average street corner. I like the story that's told not that long ago. McDonald's did an ad designed to make their restaurant seem hipper, where a young black man talks about a double cheeseburger, and says, I'd like to hit that. Well, the marketing geniuses who came up with that ad campaign thought that hit that meant I want that, when in fact it is terminology for have sex with. So the ads rapidly became a laughing stock and were pulled from production. The whole notion was, because the audience knew more about the material than the writer or the producer, the meaning was very different, and therefore the communication was very different, and what should have been an opportunity to expand a market largely became an urban joke. So what I would like to do right now is take a moment, give you a piece, and let's see how far off I am in communicating with my audience and how far I have yet to go to achieve that kind of connection in which you resonate with the work and I gain the sense that I've successfully communicated. The piece in question is The Poisoned Pen, which is a villanelle of mine I wrote a long while back, and it has its own history, which I won't bother getting into here. But here is the work. The troubadour, he knows the truth, unsuspected and unspoken, that tears the soul of every man whose heart and mind lay broken. Dreamers die, for a poet's lie, at peace with their transgressions. The miller and the blacksmith are at peace with their professions. The priest will carry on his trade and take the strange confessions. The troubadour, he knows the truth, unsuspected and unspoken. The sentry knows to challenge foes when in the night he's woken from the disturbing thought born from what is in the barrel's oaken. Dreamers die for a poet's lie, at peace with their transgressions. The mistress and the novice seek each her own perfections. The baker fires his ovens to be lost in his confections. The troubadour, he knows the truth, unsuspected and unspoken. Warriors die for causes both obscured and held as the slogan of their leaders, prayers in the shadows of holy vows now broken. Dreamers die for a poet's lie, at peace with their transgressions. Take these words as a sign of faith and as my memory's token. The realization stands apart against all false impressions. The troubadour, he knows the truth, unsuspected and unspoken. Dreamers die for a poet's lie, at peace with their transgressions. Now, was that really that difficult? Maybe it was. Maybe for you it was, and if so, I understand that. Some of the references are not from this century, indeed, barely from this millennium. But none of these words obscure the fundamental meaning of the poem, which, to be honest, if I were to ask 100 people who've read it, probably 1 in 10 could give me a reasonable perception of it. The funny thing is on the second and third and tenth readings, or upon going back to it 6 months or a year later, I find that those I've spoken with suddenly get it. Like a joke that's a little over your head. You're standing there wondering why everybody's laughing. Then a few days later, sitting in your office, you start giggling. Because it suddenly hits you what exactly that punchline meant. The punchline behind this poem isn't that complicated. It's based upon a simple concept that history is written by the winners. So, if there are those who write poems about us, sing songs to us, sing songs about us, write books about us, and they call us the victor, it's because they're on our side. So we fight our wars, our everyday wars and our global wars, for the desire to be the ones responsible for the history book. Dreamers die, for the poets lie, at peace with their transgressions. We will do things that are wrong, as long as we believe that there'll be songs about us, poems about us, paintings of us, memories of us. We want that legacy, and we want that legacy to be as good people. I mean, I believe even Adolf Hitler probably went to his grave believing he was doing the right thing. That's a horrible thought to embrace, but the truth of the matter is, I've met very few people in this life who at the bottom said, "I am an evil person." They thought they were doing the right thing. And that's the concept behind that work. And I don't think it's that obscure. In fact, I think if you come out and say it straight out, people want to be thought of as good. It doesn't carry the hammer. It doesn't insinuate itself into you. Intellect, at least one measure of it, has been determined to be how many different ways you can get to the same thought. How many different connections your brain makes to a given thought, to a given image, to a given word, to a given concept. When in poetry, or literature, or film, or music, we get to the same thought many different ways, including some that you have to think about to get to, we are giving people means to get to the same concept in different ways, so that those who couldn't find the standard path, and those that won't take that path, might through another path find their way to these truths. Poetry as a weapon, as a tool, as a collection of memes driving forward our ability to communicate and share is essential to the survival of our culture and our species. There are cultures that no longer exist except for the words they left behind. There are concepts that we could not come up with in a day, a week, a month, a year, a decade, a lifetime, but we don't have to because 100, 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years ago, someone came up with the idea, realized the idea, had the idea revealed to them, and wrote it down. And ideally wrote it down in a way that was pleasing to the senses so that it was remembered and communicated. Even today, the translations of the Bible that are only a few hundred years old, as opposed to a few thousand years old as in the original text, people argue over the specific meaning of words. There will always be language that gets dated, images that get dated. I have as often as not been accused of being too modern in the fact that I've used metaphors and allusions in my works that include computers. And I remember one reviewer talking about my use of a sonic boom in one of my poems as a poetic conceit. And he was right. But the bottom line is it communicates an image, a feeling, a sense to people. And I have no problem with that. I'd like to read you another piece right now. Give me just a moment to set this up. But I want you to be thinking about that at this point. I want you to be embracing the notion that language is timeless as long as it communicates some image to us in some part. Obviously, if you're speaking to me in French and I don't know a word of French, you're probably not going to communicate effectively with me. But if you're speaking to me in English of a few hundred years ago with different pronunciations, as long as I can pick up a word or two here or there, I can probably understand what you're saying to me. Let's move to the other end of the cultural spectrum, shall we say. Here's a piece I wrote just a few years ago It's one of my capital T poems. Those of you familiar with my works know there's about a half a dozen poems I've written where the titles are all begin with the letter T and are all in all caps. Why? One day I'll explain it. Not yet. But this poem, called Transcendence, is about my breaking away from a destructive relationship. But in it, I use metaphors that are from science. Ideally from the exploration of the surface of the moon by the Apollo missions. Note the reference to the hypergolic moments. Hypergolic fuels are those that, when they mix, automatically combust without needing to be ignited by an external source. They were used in the lunar lander so that when they had to take off again, they wouldn't have to worry about an electrical system. As soon as the fuels flowed, they ignited. And that's how they were able to have a more secure means of lifting off from the moon's surface. So here's the poem, Transcendence. The heavens are in heat tonight for this penitent, penetrative dream. The iron lion stands astride memory, manticore wings of black lace fragments of a leather lost to the weather of whim. To him alone there is an accounting. Countdown. Gray skies to brown toxic fumes as the hypergolic moments when soul and intellect touch in the ceramic chamber of a nautilus heart. The skies scream aside in a fictional friction of breath, drawn out to thread like taffy pulled too long, an obit of an orbit, undecayed as the patina colossus pulls free his lame heel from the grounding earth and raises high the last romantic verb, lift off. And I am gone, gone beyond imagination, a consecration of madness sold in gold and honeysuckle silver, quicksilver slowed to sublimate into a crystalline matrix of time. Farewell. Farewell. But it is no longer my concern, for I burn tonight in orbit no longer, stronger than an epiphany made construct in the shallows of an id. Finally, I have one last piece for you tonight. Don't quit cheering. Right after I got that comment from an editor, I went and wrote a little piece. Now, I usually don't write pieces of intention where I have a purpose in writing them. I usually just allow the thoughts to flow. But in this case, I wanted to make a point. So I tried to write a piece with very small words and no old references. Nothing before, say, 1965. And I came up with a piece that I called The Obscurantist Reflex. And this was sort of my way of thumbing my nose at them. So here it is. I do not hide what is inside my TV set from you. My cable's gone, and so I yawn and write these words for you. I'm sorry you would not see through words I choose, polysyllabic. So I'll keep it short, and with a grunt and a snort, select metaphors from Star Trek. Now, before I start getting hate mail from Trekkers, let me just say up front, I was a Trekker. I still think there are elements of the original Star Trek and the later Star Treks that are among the best stuff that's ever been on TV. My point was just, it's a commonality. It's a common, well-known metaphoric zone to invoke. And if we're only allowed to express things in the most common cultural framework, then we lose the color and flavor of our language. If we're only to have one word for dark, if we're only to have one word for love, or kiss, or breathe, or think, or hurt, there is no use for poets anymore. Because our language is far too simple. There's no shading, there's no color, there's no fringe, there's no frill. That's my view. Am I an obscurantist? to someone who doesn't understand, appreciate, or like some of the allusions I use, both the mythological and the historical? Absolutely. Just as someone who writes poems about shepherds, I would not connect with very well. Or someone who writes poems about being a drug addict. Never been one. I really couldn't connect with that. But in part, the process, even beyond the cathartic, when we're talking about the connecting with the audience, is in learning to use the language in such a way to communicate the clearest picture to the most people. And if, by using a broad palette of words and images, we can connect with as many people as possible, which is one of the reasons for universal archetypes, then we are at our best as writers. Part of the purpose of the digital renaissance has been to overthrow the constructs that obstruct us, put in our place by often well-meaning editors and publishers who want to tell us what they think is going to sell, what they think people should read. It is the limiting of ideas that obstructs us far more than any one writer or school of writers' chosen mode of communication. I would encourage you all to find writers, to find poets, to find essayists and fiction writers and nonfiction writers, films and music that speak to you. This is William F. DeVault, coming to you from out of the city. Thanks for listening, and check back in next week. We'll be a little more of a party and a little less of a lecture from a stern uncle. Take care, and thanks for listening.